facing but not looking at each other. "I'm going to take his word for it this time," he said. "I just saw him a week ago, and I agree nothing seemed unusual. But if he starts behaving strangely at all, I mean it, Will. You call me right away." "I promise," he said. He had seen Andy a few times over the years, and had always sensed his frustration, which often seemed directed toward many people at once, at himself, at Jude, and especially at Jude's friends, none of whom, Andy always managed to suggest, without ever saying it aloud, were doing a good enough job taking care of him. He liked this about Andy, his sense of outrage over Jude, even as he feared his disapproval, and also thought it somewhat unfair. And then, as it often did, once he had finished rebuking them, Andy's voice changed and became almost tender. "I know you will," he said. "It's late. Go home. Make sure you give him something to eat when he wakes up. Happy New Year." They rode home in silence. The driver had taken a single long look at Jude and said, "I need an extra $20 on the fare." "Fine," Willem had said. The sky was almost light, but he knew he wouldn't be able to sleep. In the taxi, Jude had turned away from Willem and looked out of the window, and back at the apartment, he stumbled at the doorway and walked slowly toward the bathroom, where Willem knew he would start trying to clean up. "Don't," he told him. "Go to bed." And Jude, obedient for once, changed direction and shuffled into the bedroom, where he fell asleep almost immediately. Willem sat on his own bed and watched him. He was aware suddenly of his every joint and muscle and bone, and this made him feel very, very old, and for several minutes he simply sat staring. "Jude," he called, and then again more insistently, and when Jude didn't answer, he went over to his bed and nudged him onto his back, and, after a moment's hesitation, pushed up the right sleeve of his shirt. Under his hands, the fabric didn't so much yield as it did bend and crease, like cardboard, and although he was only able to fold it to the inside of Jude's elbow, it was enough to see the three columns of neat white scars, each about an inch wide and slightly raised, laddering up his arm. He tucked his finger under the sleeve and felt the tracks continuing onto the upper arm, but stopped when he reached the bicep, unwilling to explore more, and withdrew his hand. He wasn't able to examine the left arm. Andy had cut back the sleeve on that one, and Jude's entire forearm and hand were wrapped with white gauze, but he knew he would find the same thing there. He had been lying when he told Andy he hadn't known Jude cut himself. Or rather, he hadn't known for certain, but that was only a technicality. He knew. And he had known for a long time. When they were at Malcolm's house the summer after Hemming died, he and Malcolm had gotten drunk one afternoon, and as they sat and watched J.B. and Jude, back from their walk to the dunes, fling sand at each other, Malcolm had asked, "Have you ever noticed how Jude always wears long sleeves?" He'd grunted in response. He had, of course. It was difficult not to, especially on hot days. But he had never let himself wonder why. Much of his friendship with Jude, it often seemed, was not letting himself ask the questions he knew he ought to, because he was afraid of the answers. There had been a silence then, and the two of them had watched as J.B., drunk himself, fell backward into the sand, and Jude limped over and began burying him. "Flora had a friend who always wore long sleeves," Malcolm continued. "Her name was Mariam. She used to cut herself." He let the silence pull between them until he imagined he could hear it come alive. There had been a girl in their dorm who had cut herself as well. She had been with them freshman year, but he realized he hadn't seen her at all this past year.
"Why?"
he asked Malcolm. On the sand, Jude had worked up to JB's waist. JB was singing something meandering and tuneless.
"I don't know," Malcolm said. "She had a lot of problems."
He waited, but it seemed Malcolm had nothing more to say. What happened to her? I don't know. They lost touch when Flora went to college. She never spoke about her again. They were quiet again. Somewhere along the way, he knew, it had been silently decided among the three of them that he would be primarily responsible for Jude. And this, he recognized, was Malcolm's way of presenting him with a difficulty that needed a solution, although what exactly the problem was, or what the answer might be, he wasn't certain, and he was willing to bet that Malcolm didn't know either. For the next few days, he avoided Jude, because he knew if he were alone with him, he wouldn't be able to stop himself from having a conversation with him, and he wasn't sure that he wanted to, or what that conversation would be. It wasn't hard to do. In the daytime, they were together as a group, and at night, they were each in their own rooms. But one evening, Malcolm and JB left together to pick up the lobsters, and he and Jude were left on their own in the kitchen, slicing tomatoes and washing lettuce. It had been a long, sunny, sleepy day, and Jude was in one of his light moods when he was almost carefree. And even as he asked, Willem experienced a predictive melancholy at ruining such a perfect moment, one in which everything, the pink bled sky above them, and the way the knife sliced so cleanly through the vegetables beneath them, had conspired to work so well, only to have him upset it. "Don't you want to borrow one of my t-shirts?" he asked Jude. He didn't answer until he had finished coring the tomato before him, and then gave Willem a steady, blank gaze. "No." "Aren't you hot?" Jude smiled at him, faintly, warningly. "It's going to be cold any minute now." And it was true. When the last daub of sun vanished, it would be chilly, and Willem himself would have to go back to his room for a sweater. But, and he heard in advance how absurd he would sound, how the confrontation had wriggled out of his control, cat-like, as soon as he had initiated it. "You're going to get lobster all over your sleeves." At this, Jude made a noise, a funny kind of squawk, too loud and too barky to be a real laugh, and turned back to the cutting board. "I think I can handle it, Willem," he said, and although his voice was mild, Willem saw how tightly he was holding the knife's handle, almost squeezing it, so that the bunch of his knuckles tinged a suety yellow. They were lucky then, both of them, that Malcolm and JB returned before they had to continue talking, but not before Willem heard Jude begin to ask, "Why are—" And although he never finished his sentence, and indeed didn't speak to Willem once throughout dinner, through which he kept his sleeves perfectly neat, Willem knew that his question would not have been, "Why are you asking me this?" but, "Why are you asking me this?" Because Willem had always been careful not to express too much interest in exploring the many-cupboarded cabinet in which Jude had secreted himself. If it had been anyone else, he told himself, he wouldn't have hesitated. He would have demanded answers. He would have called mutual friends. He would have sat him down and yelled and pleaded and threatened until a confession was extracted. But this was part of the deal when you were friends with Jude. He knew it, Andy knew it, they all knew it. You let things slide that your instincts told you not to. You scooted around the edges of your suspicions. You understood that proof of your friendship lay in keeping your distance, in accepting what was told you, in turning and walking away when the door was shut in your face instead of trying to force it open again. The war room discussions the four of them had had about other people, about Black Henry Young, when they thought the girl he was dating was cheating on him and were trying to decide how to tell him, about Ezra, when they knew the girl he was dating was cheating on him and were trying to decide how to tell him, they would never have about Jude. He would consider it a betrayal, and it wouldn't help anyway. For the rest of the night, they avoided each other, but on his way to bed, he found himself standing outside Jude's room, his hand hovering above the door, ready to knock, before he returned to himself. What would he say? What did he want to hear? And so he left, continued on, and the next day, when Jude made no mention of the previous evening's almost conversation, He didn't either. And soon that day turned to night, and then another, and another, and they moved further and further from his ever trying, however ineffectively, to make Jude answer a question he couldn't bring himself to ask. But it was always there, that question, and in unexpected moments it would muscle its way into his consciousness, positioning itself stubbornly at the forefront of his mind, as immovable as a troll. 4 years ago, he and J.B. were sharing an apartment and attending graduate school, and Jude, who had remained in Boston for law school, had come down to visit them. It had been night then, too, and there had been a locked bathroom door, and him banging on it abruptly, inexplicably terrified, and Jude answering it, looking irritated but also, or was he imagining this, strangely guilty, and asking him, "What, Willem?" And he once again being unable to answer but knowing that something was amiss. Inside the room had smelled sharply tannic, the rusted metal scent of blood, and he had even picked through the trash can and found a curl of bandage wrapper, but that was from dinner when J.B. had cut himself with a knife while trying to chop a carrot in his hand. Willem suspected he exaggerated his incompetency in the kitchen in order to avoid having to do any prep work, or was it from Jude's nighttime punishments? But again, he did nothing, and when he passed Jude, feigning sleep, or actually asleep, on the sofa in the living room, he said nothing. And the next day, he again said nothing, and the days unfurled before him as clean as paper. And with each day, he said nothing, and nothing, and nothing. And now there was this. If he had done something, what, 3 years ago, 8 years ago, would this have happened? And what exactly was this? But this time he would say something, because this time he had proof. This time, to let Jude slip away and evade him would mean that he himself would be culpable if anything happened. After he had resolved this, he felt the fatigue overwhelm him, felt it erase the worry and anxiety and frustration of the night. It was the last day of the year, and as he lay down on his bed and closed his eyes, the last thing he remembered feeling was surprise that he should be falling asleep so fast. It was almost 2 in the afternoon when Willem finally woke, and the first thing he remembered was his resolve from earlier that morning. Certainly things had been realigned to discourage his sense of initiative. Jude's bed was clean. Jude was not in it. The bathroom, when he visited it, smelled eggily of bleach. And at the card table, there was Jude himself, stamping circles into dough with a stoicism that made Willem both annoyed and relieved. If he was to confront Jude, it seemed, it would be without the benefit of disarray, the evidence of disaster. He slouched into the chair across from him. "What are you doing?" Jude didn't look up. "Making more gougères," he said calmly. "One of the batches I made yesterday isn't quite right." "No one's going to fucking care, Jude," he said meanly, and then, barreling helplessly forward, "we could just give them cheese sticks and it'd be the same thing." Jude shrugged, and Willem felt his annoyance quicken into anger. Here Jude sat after what was, he could now admit, a terrifying night, acting as if nothing had happened, even as his bandage-wrapped hand lay uselessly on the table. He was about to speak when Jude put down the water glass he'd been using as a pastry cutter and looked at him.
"I'm really sorry, Willem," he said,
so softly that Willem almost couldn't hear him. He saw Willem looking at his hand and pulled it into his lap.
"I should never..."
He paused.
"I'm sorry. Don't be mad at me."
His anger dissolved.
"Jude," he asked, "what were you doing?"
"Not what you think. I promise you, Willem."
Years later, Willem would recount this conversation, its contours, if not its actual literal content, for Malcolm as proof of his own incompetence, his own failure. How might things have been different if he spoke only one sentence? And that sentence could have been, "Jude, are you trying to kill yourself?" Or, "Jude, you need to tell me what's going on." Or, "Jude, why do you do this to yourself?" Any of those would have been acceptable. Any one of those would have led to a larger conversation that would have been reparative, or at the very least preventative. Wouldn't it? But there, in the moment, he instead only mumbled, "Okay." They sat in silence for what felt like a long time, listening to the murmur of one of their neighbors' televisions, and it was only much later that Willem would wonder whether Jude had been saddened or relieved that he had been so readily believed.
"Are you mad at me?"
"No." He cleared his throat. And he wasn't, or at least mad was not the word he would have chosen, because he couldn't then articulate what word would be correct.
"But we obviously have to cancel the party."
At this, Jude looked alarmed.
"Why? Why? Are you kidding me?"
"Willem," Jude said, adopting what Willem thought of as his litigatory tone,
"we can't cancel. People are going to be showing up in 7 hours, less, and we really have no clue who JB's invited. They're going to show up anyway, even if we let everyone else know. And besides,"
he inhaled sharply, as if he'd had a lung infection and was trying to prove it had resolved itself,
"I'm perfectly fine. It'll be more difficult if we cancel than if we just go forward."
Oh, how and why did he always listen to Jude? But he did, once again. And soon it was 8, and the windows were once again open, and the kitchen was once again hot with pastry, as if the previous night had never happened, as if those hours had been an illusion, and Malcolm and JB were arriving. Willem stood in the door of their bedroom, buttoning up his shirt and listening to Jude tell them that he had burned his arm baking the gougères, and that Andy had had to apply a salve.
"I told you not to make those fucking gougères,"
he could hear JB say happily. He loved Jude's baking. He was overcome then with a powerful sensation. He could close the door and go to sleep, and when he woke, it would be a new year, and everything would be wiped fresh, and he wouldn't feel that deep, writhing discomfort inside of him. The thought of seeing Malcolm and JB, of interacting with them and smiling and joking, seemed suddenly excruciating. But, of course, see them he did, and when JB demanded they all go up to the roof so he could get some fresh air and have a smoke, he let Malcolm complain uselessly and half-heartedly about how cold it was without joining in, before resignedly following the three of them up the narrow staircase that led to the tar-papered roof. He knew that he was sulking, and he removed himself to the back of the building, letting the others talk without him. Above him, the sky was already completely dark, midnight dark. If he faced north, he could see directly beneath him the art supply store where JB had been working part-time since quitting the magazine a month ago, and in the distance, the Empire State Building's gaudy, graceless bulk, its tower aglow with a garish blue light that made him think of gas stations, and the long drive back to his parents' house from Hemming's hospital bed so many years ago. "Guys," he called over to the others, "it's cold." He wasn't wearing his coat. None of them were. "Let's go." But when he went to the door that opened into the building's stairwell, the handle wouldn't turn. He tried it again. It wouldn't budge. They were locked out.
"Fuck!"
he shouted.
"Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!"
"Jesus, Willem,"
said Malcolm, startled because Willem rarely got angry.
"Jude, do you have the key?"
But Jude didn't.
"Fuck!"
He couldn't help himself. Everything felt so wrong. He couldn't look at Jude. He blamed him, which was unfair. He blamed himself, which was more fair, but which made him feel worse.
"Who's got their phone?"
But, idiotically, no one had his phone. They were down in the apartment, where they themselves should have been, were it not for fucking JB and for fucking Malcolm, who so unquestioningly followed everything JB said, every stupid, half-formed idea, and for fucking Jude as well, for last night, for the past 9 years, for hurting himself, for not letting himself be helped, for frightening and unnerving him, for making him feel so useless, for everything. For a while they screamed. They pounded their feet on the rooftop in the hopes that someone beneath them, one of their three neighbors, whom they'd still never met, might hear them. Malcolm suggested throwing something at the windows of one of the neighboring buildings, but they had nothing to throw. Even their wallets were downstairs, tucked cozily into their coat pockets, and all the windows were dark besides.
"Listen," Jude said at last,
even though the last thing Willem wanted to do was listen to Jude.
"I have an idea. Lower me down to the fire escape, and I'll break in through the bedroom window."
The idea was so stupid that he initially couldn't respond. It sounded like something that JB would imagine, not Jude.
"No," he said, flatly. "That's crazy."
"Why?"
asked JB.
"I think it's a great plan."
The fire escape was an unreliable, ill-conceived, and mostly useless object, a rusted metal skeleton affixed to the front of the building between the fifth and third floors, like a particularly ugly bit of decoration. From the roof, it was a drop of about 9 feet to the landing, which ran half the width of their living room. Even if they could safely get Jude down to it without triggering one of his episodes or having him break his leg, he'd have to crane over its edge in order to reach the bedroom window.
"Absolutely not," he told JB,
and the two of them argued for a bit until Willem realized, with a growing sense of dismay, that it was the only possible solution.
"But not Jude," he said. "I will."
"You can't."
"Why?"
"We won't need to break in through the bedroom anyway. I'll just go in through one of the living room windows."
The living room windows were barred, but one of them was missing, and Willem thought he might be able to squeeze between the two remaining bars, just. Anyway, he'd have to.
"I closed the windows before we came up here," Jude admitted in a small voice,
and Willem knew that meant he'd also locked them, because he locked anything that could be. Doors, windows, closets. It was reflexive for him. The bedroom window's lock was broken, however, so Jude had fashioned a mechanism, a complex, blocky thing made from bolts and wire that he claimed secured it completely. He had always been mystified by Jude's hyper-preparedness, his dedication to finding disaster everywhere. He had long ago noticed Jude's habit of, upon entering any new room or space, searching for the nearest exit and then standing close to it, which had initially been funny and then somehow became less so, and his equal dedication to implementing preventative measures whenever he could. One night, the two of them had been awake, late in their bedroom, talking, and Jude had told him, quietly, as if he was confessing something precious, that the bedroom window's mechanism could in fact be opened from the outside, but that he was the only person who knew how to unjam it.
"Why are you telling me this?" he'd asked.
"Because," Jude had said, "I think we should get it fixed, properly."
"But if you're the only one who knows how to open it, why does it matter?"
They didn't have extra money for a locksmith, not to come fix a problem that wasn't a problem. They couldn't ask the superintendent. After they had moved in, Annika had admitted that she technically wasn't allowed to sublet the apartment, but as long as they didn't cause any problems, she thought the landlord wouldn't bother them. And so they tried not to cause problems. They made their own repairs, they patched their own walls, they fixed the plumbing themselves.
"Just in case," Jude had said. "I just want to know we're safe."
"Jude," he'd said, "we're going to be safe. Nothing's going to happen. No one's going to break in."
And then, when Jude was silent, he sighed, gave up.
"I'll call the locksmith tomorrow," he'd said.
"Thank you, Willem,"
Jude had said. But in the end, he'd never called. That had been 2 months ago, and now they were standing in the cold on their roof, and that window was their only hope.
Fuck, fuck,
he groaned. His head hurt.
Just tell me how to do it and I'll open it.
It's too difficult, Jude said.
By now they had forgotten Malcolm and J.B. were standing there watching them, J.B. quiet for once.
I won't be able to explain it. Yeah, I know you think I'm a fucking moron, but I can figure it out if you only use small words,
he snapped.
Willem,
said Jude, surprised, and there was a silence.
That's not what I meant.
I know, he said. Sorry. I know.
He took a deep breath.
Even if we were to do this, though, and I don't think we should, how would we even lower you down?
Jude walked to the edge of the roof, which was bordered on each side by a flat-topped shin-high wall, and peered over it.
I'll sit on the wall looking out, directly above the fire escape, he said. Then you and J.B. should both sit by it. Each of you hold one of my hands, with both of your own, and then you lower me down. Once you can't reach anymore, you'll let go and I'll drop the rest of the way.
He laughed. It was so risky and dumb.
And if we did this, how would you reach the bedroom window?
Jude looked at him.
You're going to have to trust I can do it.
This is stupid.
J.B. stopped him.
This is the only plan, Willem. It's fucking freezing out here.
And it was. Only his rage was keeping him warm.
Have you not noticed his whole fucking arm is completely bandaged up, J.B.?
But I'm fine, Willem,
said Jude, before J.B. could respond. It was 10 more minutes of the two of them bickering until Jude finally marched back over to the edge.
If you won't help me, Willem, Malcolm will,
he said, although Malcolm looked terrified as well.
No,
he said, I will. And so he and J.B. knelt and pressed themselves against the wall, each holding one of Jude's hands with both of their own. By now it was so cold that he could barely feel his fingers close around Jude's palm. He had Jude's left hand, and all he could sense anyway was its cushion of gauze. As he squeezed it, an image of Andy's face floated before him, and he was sick with guilt. Jude pushed off the side of the ledge, and Malcolm gave a little moan that ended in a squeak. Willem and J.B. leaned over as far as they could, until they were in danger of tipping over the edge themselves, and when Jude called to them to let go, they did, and watched him land in a clatter on the slat-floored fire escape beneath them. J.B. cheered, and Willem wanted to smack him.
I'm fine,
Jude shouted up to them, and waved his bandaged hand in the air like a flag before moving over to the edge of the fire escape, where he pulled himself up onto its railing, so he could start untangling the implement. He had his legs twined around one of the railing's iron spindles, but his position was precarious, and Willem watched him sway a little, trying to keep his balance, his fingers moving slowly from numbness and cold.
Get me down there,
he said to Malcolm and J.B., ignoring Malcolm's fluttery protests, and then he went over the edge himself, calling down to Jude before he did, so his arrival wouldn't upset his equilibrium. The drop was scarier, and the landing harder than he had thought it would be, but he made himself recover quickly and went over to where Jude was and wrapped his arms around his waist, tucking his leg around a spindle to brace himself.
I've got you,
he said, and Jude leaned out over the edge of the railing, farther than he could have done on his own, and Willem held on to him so tightly that he could feel the knuckles of Jude's spine through his sweater, could feel his stomach sink and rise as he breathed, could feel the echo of his fingers' movements through his muscles as he twisted and unkinked the twigs of wire that were fastening the window into its stile. And when it was done, Willem climbed onto the railing and into the bedroom first, and then reached out again to pull Jude in by his arms, careful to avoid his bandages. They stood back on the inside, panting from the effort, and looked at each other. It was so deliciously warm inside this room, even with the cold air gusting in, that he at last let himself feel weak with relief. They were safe. They had been spared. Jude grinned at him then, and he grinned back. If it had been J.B. before him, he would have hugged him out of sheer stupid giddiness. But Jude wasn't a hugger, and so he didn't. But then Jude raised his hand to brush some of the rust flakes out of his hair, and Willem saw that on the inside of his wrist, his bandage was stained with a deep burgundy splotch, and recognized belatedly that the rapidity of Jude's breathing was not just from exertion, but from pain. He watched as Jude sat heavily on his bed, his white-wrapped hand reaching behind him to make sure he would land on something solid. Willem crouched beside him. His elation was gone, replaced by something else. He felt himself weirdly close to tears, although he couldn't have said why. "Jude," he began, but he didn't know how to continue.
"You'd better get them," Jude said,
and although each word came out as a gasp, he smiled at Willem again.
"Fuck 'em," he said. "I'll stay here with you."
And Jude laughed a little, although he winced as he did so, and carefully tipped himself backward until he was lying on his side, and Willem helped lift his legs up onto the bed. His sweater was freckled with more flecks of rust, and Willem picked some of them off of him. He sat on the bed next to him, unsure where to begin.
"Jude,"
he tried again.
"Go,"
Jude said, and closed his eyes, although he was still smiling, and Willem reluctantly stood, shutting the window and turning off the bedroom light as he left, closing the door behind him, heading for the stairwell to save Malcolm and J.B., while far beneath him he could hear the buzzer reverberating through the staircase, announcing the arrival of the evening's first guests. Part 2. The Postman. Chapter 1. Saturdays were for work, but Sundays were for walking. The walks had begun out of necessity 5 years ago, when he had moved to the city and knew little about it. Each week he would choose a different neighborhood and walk from Lispenard Street to it, and then around it, covering its perimeter precisely, and then home again. He never skipped a Sunday unless the weather made it near impossible, and even now, even though he had walked every neighborhood in Manhattan, and many in Brooklyn and Queens as well, he still left every Sunday morning at 10 and returned only when his route was complete. The walks had long ceased to be something he enjoyed, although he didn't not enjoy them either. It was simply something he did. For a period, he had also hopefully considered them something more than exercise, something perhaps restorative, like an amateur physical therapy session, despite the fact that Andy didn't agree with him and indeed disapproved of his walks. "I'm fine with you wanting to exercise your legs," he'd said, "but in that case, you should really be swimming, not dragging yourself up and down pavement." He shouldn't have minded swimming, actually, but there was nowhere private enough for him to swim, and so he didn't. Willem had occasionally joined him on these walks, and now, if his route took him past the theater, he would time it so they would meet at the juice stand down the block after the matinee performance. They would have their drinks, and Willem would tell him how the show had gone, and would buy a salad to eat before the evening performance, and he would continue south toward home. They still lived at Lispenard Street, although both of them could have moved into their own apartments. He, certainly. Willem, probably. But neither of them had ever mentioned leaving to the other, and so neither of them had. They had, however, annexed the left half of the living room to make a second bedroom, the group of them building a lumpy sheet-rocked wall one weekend, so now when you walked in, there was only the gray light from two windows, not four, to greet you. Willem had taken the new bedroom, and he had stayed in their old one. Aside from their stage door visits, it felt like he never saw Willem these days, and for all Willem talked about how lazy he was, it seemed he was constantly at work, or trying to work. 3 years ago, on his 29th birthday, he had sworn that he was going to quit Ortolan before he turned 30. And 2 weeks before his 30th birthday, the two of them had been in the apartment, squashed into their newly partitioned living room, Willem worrying about whether he could actually afford to leave his job, when he got a call. The call that he had been waiting for years. The play that had resulted from that call had been enough of a success and had gotten Willem enough attention to allow him to quit Ortolan for good 13 months later, just 1 year past his self-imposed deadline. He had gone to see Willem's play, a family drama called The Malamud Theorem, about a literature professor in the early throes of dementia and his estranged son, a physicist, 5 times. Twice with Malcolm and J.B., and once with Harold and Julia, who were in town for the weekend, and each time he managed to forget that it was his old friend, his roommate, on stage, and at curtain call he had felt both proud and wistful, as if the stage's very elevation announced Willem's ascendancy to some other realm of life, one not easily accessible to him. His own approach to 30 had triggered no latent panic, no fluster of activity, no need to rearrange the outlines of his life to more closely resemble what a 30-year-old's life ought to be. The same was not true for his friends, however, and he had spent the last 3 years of his 20s listening to their eulogies for the decade, and their detailing of what they had and hadn't done, and the cataloging of their self-loathings and promises. Things had changed then. The second bedroom, for example, was erected partly out of Willem's fear of being 28 and still sharing a room with his college roommate, and that same anxiety, the fear that, fairy tale-like, the turn into their fourth decade would transform them into something else, something out of their control, unless they preempted it with their own radical announcements, inspired Malcolm's hasty coming out to his parents, only to see him retreat back in the following year when he started dating a woman. But despite his friends' anxieties, he knew he would love being 30, for the very reason that they hated it, because it was an age of undeniable adulthood. He looked forward to being 35, when he would be able to say he had been an adult for more than twice as long as he had been a child. When he was growing up, 30 had been a far-off, unimaginable age. He clearly remembered being a very young boy, this was when he lived in the monastery, and asking Brother Michael, who liked to tell him of the travels he had taken in his other life, when he too might be able to travel. "When you're older," Brother Michael had said. "When?" he'd asked.
"Next year."
Then, even a month had seemed as long as forever. "Many years," Brother Michael had said. "When you're older, when you're 30. And now, in just a few weeks, he would be. On those Sundays when he was readying to leave for his walk, he would sometimes stand barefoot in the kitchen, everything quiet around him, and the small, ugly apartment would feel like a sort of marvel. Here, time was his, and space was his, and every door could be shut, every window locked. He would stand before the tiny hallway closet, an alcove, really, over which they had strung a length of burlap, and admire the stores within it. At Lispenard Street, there were no late-night scrambles to the bodega on West Broadway for a roll of toilet paper, no squinching your nose above a container of long-spoiled milk found in the back corner of the refrigerator. Here, there was always extra. Here, everything was replaced when it needed to be. He made sure of it. In their first year at Lispenard Street, he had been self-conscious about his habits, which he knew belonged to someone much older and probably female, and had hidden his supplies of paper towels under his bed, had stuffed the flyers for coupons into his briefcase to look through later when Willem wasn't home, as if they were a particularly exotic form of pornography. But one day Willem had discovered his stash while looking for a stray sock he'd kicked under the bed. He had been embarrassed.
"Why?" Willem had asked him. "I think it's great. Thank God you're looking out for this kind of stuff."
But it had still made him feel vulnerable, Yet another piece of evidence added to the overstuffed file testifying to his pinched prissiness, his fundamental and irreparable inability to be the sort of person he tried to make people believe he was. And yet, as with so much else, he couldn't help himself. To whom could he explain that he found as much contentment and safety in unloved Lispenard Street, in his bomb shelter stockpilings, as he did in the facts of his degrees and his job? Or that those moments alone in the kitchen were something akin to meditative, the only times he found himself truly relaxing, his mind ceasing to scrabble forward, planning in advance the thousands of little deflections and smudgings of truth, of fact, that necessitated his every interaction with the world and its inhabitants? To no one, he knew, not even to Willem. But he'd had years to learn how to keep his thoughts to himself. Unlike his friends, he had learned not to share evidence of his oddities as a way to distinguish himself from others, although he was happy and proud that they shared theirs with him. Today he would walk to the Upper East Side, up West Broadway to Washington Square Park, to University and through Union Square, and up Broadway to Fifth, which he'd stay on until 86th Street, and then back down Madison to 24th Street, where he'd cross east to Lexington before continuing south and east once more to Irving, where he'd meet Willem outside the theater. It had been months, almost a year, since he had done this circuit, both because it was very far and because he already spent every Saturday on the Upper East Side, in a townhouse not far from Malcolm's parents, where he tutored a 12-year-old boy named Felix. But it was mid-March, spring break, and Felix and his family were on vacation in Utah, which meant he ran no risk of seeing them. Felix's father was a friend of Malcolm's parents, and it had been Malcolm's father who had gotten him the job. "They're really not paying you enough at the U.S. Attorney's Office, are they?" Mr. Irvine had asked him. "I don't know why you don't just let me introduce you to Gavin." Gavin was one of Mr. Irvine's law school friends, who now presided over one of the city's more powerful firms. "Dad, he doesn't want to work for some corporate firm," Malcolm had begun, but his father continued talking as if Malcolm hadn't even spoken, and Malcolm had hunched back into his chair. He had felt bad for Malcolm then, but also annoyed, as he had told Malcolm to discreetly inquire whether his parents knew anyone who might have a kid who needed tutoring, not to actually ask them. "Really, though," Malcolm's father had said to him, "I think it's terrific that you're interested in making your way on your own." Malcolm slouched even lower in his seat. "But do you really need the money that badly? I didn't think the federal government paid that miserably, but it's been a long time since I was in public service." He grinned. He smiled back. "No," he said, "the salary's fine." It was. It wouldn't have been to Mr. Irvine, of course, nor to Malcolm, but it was more money than he had ever dreamed he would have, and every 2 weeks it arrived, a relentless accumulation of numbers. "I'm just saving up for a down payment." He saw Malcolm's face swivel toward him, and he reminded himself to tell Willem the particular lie he had told Malcolm's father before Malcolm told Willem himself. "Oh, well, good for you," said Mr. Irvine. This was a goal he could understand. "And as it happens, I know just the person." That person was Howard Baker, who had hired him after interviewing him for 15 distracted minutes to tutor his son in Latin, math, German, and piano. He wondered why Mr. Baker wasn't hiring professionals for each subject. He could have afforded it, but didn't ask. He felt sorry for Felix, who was small and unappealing, and who had a habit of scratching the inside of one narrow nostril, his index finger tunneling upward until he remembered himself and quickly retracted it, rubbing it on the side of his jeans. 8 months later, it was still unclear to him just how capable Felix was. He wasn't stupid, but he suffered from a lack of passion, as if, at 12, he had already become resigned to the fact that life would be a disappointment, and he a disappointment to the people in it. He was always waiting, On time, and with his assignments completed, every Saturday at 1 p.m., and he obediently answered every question, his answers always ending in an anxious, querying upper register, as if every one, even the simplest,
Salve Felix quid ages? Benny?
Were a desperate guess. But he never had any questions of his own, and when he asked Felix if there was any subject in particular he might want to try discussing in either language, Felix would shrug and mumble, his finger drifting toward his nose. He always had the impression, when waving goodbye to Felix at the end of the afternoon, Felix listlessly raising his own hand before slouching back into the recesses of the entryway, that he never left the house, never went out, never had friends over. Poor Felix. His very name was a taunt. The previous month, Mr. Baker had asked to speak to him after their lessons were over, and he had said goodbye to Felix and followed the maid into the study. His limp had been very pronounced that day, and he had been self-conscious, feeling, as he often did, as if he were playing the role of an impoverished governess in a Dickensian drama. He had expected impatience from Mr. Baker, perhaps anger, even though Felix was doing quantifiably better in school, and he was ready to defend himself if he needed. Mr. Baker paid far more than he had anticipated, and he had plans for the money he was earning there. But he was instead nodded toward the chair in front of the desk. "What do you think's wrong with Felix?" Mr. Baker had demanded. He hadn't been expecting the question, so he had to think before he answered.
"I don't think there's anything wrong with him, sir," he'd said, carefully. "I just think he's not happy," he nearly said.
But what was happiness but an extravagance, an impossible state to maintain, partly because it was so difficult to articulate? He couldn't remember being a child and being able to define happiness. There was only misery or fear, and the absence of misery or fear, and the latter state was all he had needed or wanted.
"I think he's shy," he finished.
Mr. Baker grunted. This was obviously not the answer he was looking for. "But you like him, right?" he'd asked him, with such an odd, vulnerable desperation that he experienced a sudden deep sadness, both for Felix and for Mr. Baker. Was this what being a parent was like? Was this what being a child with a parent was like? Such unhappinesses, such disappointments, such expectations that would go unexpressed and unmet? "Of course," he had said. And Mr. Baker had sighed and given him his check, which the maid usually handed to him on his way out. The next week, Felix hadn't wanted to play his assignment. He was more listless than usual.
"Shall we play something else?" he'd asked.
Felix had shrugged. He thought.
"Do you want me to play something for you?"
Felix had shrugged again. But he did anyway, because it was a beautiful piano, and sometimes, as he watched Felix inch his fingers across its lovely, smooth keys, he longed to be alone with the instrument and let his hands move over its surface as fast as he could. He played Haydn Sonata No. 50 in D major, one of his favorite pieces, and so bright and likable that he thought it might cheer them both up. But when he was finished, and there was only the quiet boy sitting next to him, he was ashamed, both of the braggy, emphatic optimism of the Haydn and of his own burst of self-indulgence.
"Felix," he'd begun, and then stopped.
Beside him, Felix waited.
"What's wrong?"
And then, to his astonishment, Felix had begun to cry, and he had tried to comfort him.
"Felix," he'd said, awkwardly putting his arm around him.
He pretended he was Willem, who would have known exactly what to do and what to say without even thinking about it.
"It's going to be all right. I promise you. It will be."
But Felix had only cried harder.
"I don't have any friends,"
Felix had sobbed.
"Oh, Felix,"
he'd said, and his sympathy, which until then had been of the remote, objective kind, clarified itself.
I'm sorry.
He felt then keenly the loneliness of Felix's life, of a Saturday spent sitting with a crippled, nearly 30-year-old lawyer who was there only to earn money and who would go out that night with people he loved and who even loved him, while Felix remained alone, his mother, Mrs. Baker's third wife, perpetually elsewhere, his father convinced there was something wrong with him, something that needed fixing. Later, on his walk home, if the weather was nice, he refused Mr. Baker's car and walked. He would wonder at the unlikely unfairness of it all. Felix, who was by any definition a better kid than he had been, and who yet had no friends, and he, who was a nothing, who did.
Felix, it'll happen eventually, he'd said.
And Felix had wailed,
but when?
With such yearning that he had winced.
Soon, soon,
he had told him, petting his skinny back.
I promise.
And Felix had nodded, although later, walking him to the door, his little gecko-y face made even more reptilian from tears, he'd had the distinct sensation that Felix had known he was lying. Who could know if Felix would ever have friends? Friendship, companionship, it so often defied logic, so often eluded the deserving, so often settled itself on the odd, the bad, the peculiar, the damaged. He waved goodbye at Felix's small back, retreating already into the house, and although he would never have said so to Felix, he somehow fancied that this was why Felix was so wan all the time. It was because Felix had already figured this out long ago. It was because he already knew. He knew French and German. He knew the periodic table. He knew, as much as he didn't care to, large parts of the Bible almost by memory. He knew how to help birth a calf and rewire a lamp and unclog a drain and the most efficient way to harvest a walnut tree and which mushrooms were poisonous and which were not, and how to bale hay, and how to test a watermelon, an apple, a squash, a muskmelon for freshness, by thunking it in the right spot. And then he knew things he wished he didn't, things he hoped never to have to use again, things that, when he thought of them or dreamed of them at night, made him curl into himself with hatred and shame. And yet it often seemed he knew nothing of any real value or use, not really. The languages and the math, fine. But daily he was reminded of how much he didn't know. He had never heard of the sitcoms whose episodes were constantly referenced. He had never been to a movie. He had never gone on vacation. He had never been to summer camp. He had never had pizza or popsicles or macaroni and cheese, and he had certainly never had, as both Malcolm and J.B. had, foie gras or sushi or marrow. He had never owned a computer or a phone. He had rarely been allowed to go online. He had never owned anything, he realized, not really. The books he had that he was so proud of, the shirts that he repaired again and again, they were nothing. They were trash. The pride he took in them was more shameful than not owning anything at all. The classroom was the safest place, and the only place he felt fully confident. Everywhere else was an unceasing avalanche of marvels, each more baffling than the next, each another reminder of his bottomless ignorance. He found himself keeping mental lists of new things he had heard and encountered, but he could never ask anyone for the answers. To do so would be an admission of extreme otherness, which would invite further questions and would leave him exposed, and which would inevitably lead to conversations he definitely was not prepared to have. He felt often not so much foreign, for even the foreign students, even Advall, from a village outside Ulaanbaatar, seemed to understand these references as from another time altogether. His childhood might well have been spent in the 19th century, not the 21st, for all he had apparently missed, and for how obscure and merely decorative what he did know seemed to be. How was it that apparently all of his peers, whether they were born in Lagos or Los Angeles, had had more or less the same experience with the same cultural landmarks? Surely there was someone who knew as little as he did. And if not, how was he ever to catch up? In the evenings, when a group of them lay splayed in someone's room, a candle burning, a joint burning as well, the conversation often turned to his classmates' childhoods, which they had barely left, but about which they were curiously nostalgic and certainly obsessed. They recounted what seemed like every detail of them, though he was never sure if the goal was to compare with one another their similarities or to boast of their differences, because they seemed to take equal pleasure in both. They spoke of curfews and rebellions and punishments. A few people's parents had hit them, and they related those stories with something close to pride, which he also found curious, and pets and siblings, and what they had worn that had driven their parents crazy, and what groups they had hung out with in high school, and to whom they had lost their virginity, and where, and how, and cars they had crashed, and bones they had broken, and sports they had played, and bands they had started. They spoke of disastrous family vacations, and strange, colorful relatives, and odd next-door neighbors and teachers, both beloved and loathed. He enjoyed these divulgences more than he expected. These were real teenagers who'd had the sorts of real, plain lives he had always wondered about, and he found it both relaxing and educational to sit there late at night and listen to them. His silence was both a necessity and a protection, and had the added benefit of making him appear more mysterious and more interesting than he knew he was. "What about you, Jude?" a few people had asked him early in the term, and he knew enough by then, he was a fast learner, to simply shrug and say with a smile, "It's too boring to get into." He was astonished but relieved by how easily they accepted that, and grateful too for their self-absorption. None of them really wanted to listen to someone else's story anyway. They only wanted to tell their own. And yet his silence did not go unnoticed by everyone, and it was his silence that had inspired his nickname. This was the year Malcolm discovered postmodernism, and J.B. had made such a fuss about how late Malcolm was to that particular ideology that he hadn't admitted that he hadn't heard of it either. "You can't just decide you're post-black, Malcolm," J.B. had said. "And also, you have to have actually been black to begin with in order to move beyond blackness." "You're such a dick, J.B.," Malcolm had said. "Or," J.B. had continued, "you have to be so genuinely uncategorizable that the normal terms of identity don't even apply to you." J.B. had turned toward him then, and he had felt himself freeze with a momentary terror. "Like Judy here. We never see him with anyone. We don't know what race he is. We don't know anything about him. Post-sexual, post-racial, post-identity, post-past." He smiled at him, presumably to show he was at least partly joking. "The postman. Jude the postman." "The postman," Malcolm had repeated. He was never above grabbing onto someone else's discomfort as a way of deflecting attention from his own. And although the name didn't stick, when Willem had returned to the room and heard it, he had only rolled his eyes in response, which seemed to remove some of its thrill for J.B. He was reminded that as much as he had convinced himself he was fitting in, as much as he worked to conceal the spiky, odd parts of himself, he was fooling no one. They knew he was strange, and now his foolishness extended to his having convinced himself that he had convinced them that he wasn't. Still, he kept attending the late-night groups, kept joining his classmates in their rooms. He was pulled to them, even though he now knew he was putting himself in jeopardy by attending them. Sometimes during these sessions, he had begun to think of them this way, as intensive tutorials in which he could correct his own cultural paucities. He would catch Willem watching him with an indecipherable expression on his face, and would wonder how much Willem might have guessed about him. Sometimes he had to stop himself from saying something to him. Maybe he was wrong. he sometimes thought.
Maybe it would be nice to confess to someone that most of the time he could barely relate to what was being discussed, that he couldn't participate in everyone else's shared language of childhood pratfalls and frustrations. But then he would stop himself, for admitting ignorance of that language would mean having to explain the one he did.